This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Armistead Maupin is best known for his Tales of the City, which started as a story serialized in newspapers and was expanded into several best-selling novels and two TV miniseries, one of which won a Peabody Award. The stories were set in San Francisco and revolved around a group of gay and straight friends of different generations. Maupin's new work is a semi-autobiographical novel called The Night Listener. The main character, Gabriel Noon, writes stories very similar to Maupin's Tales of the City, but Noon serializes his stories on the radio, in fact on NPR. Noon's life is changed as one person leaves him and another enters his life. The person entering his life is Pete, a 13-year-old fan who has written a not-yet-published memoir about being abused by his parents. The person leaving Noon is his longtime lover, Jess, a character based in part on Maupin's former lover, Terry Anderson, to whom the new novel is dedicated. Let's start with a short reading.
I wasn't myself the afternoon that Pete appeared, or maybe more severely myself than I had ever been. Jess had left me 2 weeks earlier, and I was raw with the realization of it. I have never known sorrow to be such a physical thing, an actual presence that weighed on my limbs like something wet and woolen. I couldn't write, or wouldn't at any rate, unable to face the grueling self-scrutiny that fiction demands. I would feed the dog, walk him, check the mail, feed myself, do the dishes, lie on the sofa for hours watching television. Everything seemed pertinent to my pain. The silliest coffee commercial could plunge me into profound Chekhovian gloom. There was no way around the self-doubt or the panic or the anger. My marriage had exploded in midair, strewing itself across the landscape, and all I could do was search the rubble for some sign of a probable cause, some telltale black box. The things I knew for sure had become a litany I recited to friends on the telephone. Jess had taken an apartment on Buena Vista Park. He wanted space, he said, a place to be alone. He had spent a decade expecting to die, and now he planned to think about living. He could actually do that, he realized, without having to call it denial. He would meditate and read and focus on himself for once. He couldn't say for sure when he'd be back, or if he'd ever be back, or if I'd even want him when it was over. I was not to take this personally, he said. It had nothing to do with me. Then, after stuffing his saddlebags full of protease inhibitors, he pecked me solemnly on the lips and mounted the red motorcycle he had taught himself to ride 6 months earlier. I'd never trusted that machine. Now, as I watched it roar off down the hill, I realized why. It had always seemed made for this moment.
Thanks, Armistead. That's Armistead Maupin reading from his new novel, The Night Listener. Well, I think that pretty well sets the scene. As the main character's lover has walked out on him, a boy enters his life. Who is he?
He's a boy who lives in the snowy depths of Wisconsin, who is a fan of Gabriel Noon. Gabriel Noon himself is a radio storyteller, a man who tells stories on NPR, as it happens, late at night, and has a bit of a cult following around the country. And this little boy, who's 13 years old, has fixated on the storyteller in such a way as to think of him in paternal terms. He hears this voice and relates to him. The child has a horrific past of sexual abuse, and he connects with this storyteller in such a way that the two of them are able to unload their hearts to each other, as it were.
And their connection is really on the telephone because they're in different places.
That's right.
And Gabriel is somebody who never really wanted to be a father figure, but he's becoming a father figure to this young boy. What are the most pleasant surprises for Gabriel about becoming a father figure?
I began to pursue this particular storyline because at the age of 50 or so, I began to realize that I was actually having paternalistic feelings about other people in my life. I really can truly say that I myself, like Gabriel Noon, have never wanted to have a child. I've never missed that because of the life I've led as a gay man. But I do have feelings that that approach paternalism that I've felt towards, in particular, a godson that Terry and I have up in Inverness County, up in Inverness, Marin County, that we've both known since he was 7 years old, and a remarkably mature kid that has had amazing conversations with me. When Terry and I broke up, it was Nick was the one that we needed to explain ourselves to. And there have been other people in my life, gay men, younger gay men, who towards whom I feel this different kind of love that I've never really expressed because I haven't been old enough to express it or I haven't had children.
Now, one thing that Gabriel, your character, runs up against is that he starts thinking that this boy he's communicating with on the phone might not actually exist.
Yes, I hope we won't go too much beyond this.
That's about where I was going to end.
I want this thing to be a ride for people. The Night Listener kind of grew out of a feeling that I've had for many years that I wanted to write something that accomplished what Vertigo did for me when I was 14 years old, the age of Pete, as it happens. I was so overwhelmed by this film that was about passion and obsession and love and loss, this deep loss, sense of loss that was all wrapped up in a mystery story, that for years I thought I would really love to accomplish the same thing, a sort of thriller of the heart that compels people to read because a mystery is unfolding, but digs rather deeply into the human condition and reveals things about the soul of the writer and hopefully the souls of the readers.
Now, Gabriel, your main character, does this radio serial. Did you make him a radio person so that Gabriel would be an invisible presence in people's lives, just as this boy is a kind of invisible presence in Gabriel's life?
I did. That's very observant of you. That occurred to me into the writing of it, that this was really about voices. It was about the way in which voices soothe us and seduce us and allow our fantasies to grow. When I was a kid and listened to radio serials back in the early 50s in North Carolina, they stimulated my imagination in a way that it hasn't been stimulated since, because television and film basically are about staring into boxes. But voices can do anything. They can go anywhere and be anything, and we can construct whole worlds around them because we have to, because there's nothing else there. You must have found this yourself with people imagining things about you from hearing your voice on the radio.
Yes, and they're always surprised when they meet me because I look nothing like the way they've constructed me in their minds.
And it's something that can work very well in the context of a suspense novel, because novels are about words, and we build those voices in our heads as we read, and we build the faces for those faceless people as we read.
Did writing this book get you listening to the radio any differently than you usually do?
No, it really didn't. It got me to thinking about what it would be like to perform on the radio. I realized that I've always written in order to imagine my future. If there's something that's not happening in my life that I would like to have happening, I sometimes imagine myself in that situation before it occurs. I imagined myself as coming out to my parents in More Tales of the City in a letter that a fictional character wrote to his parents, and that in turn created a situation that enabled me to come out to my own parents. The same thing happened with this novel in terms of my relationship to my own father. There is a character in The Night Listener who is based on, I think I can say safely, my own father, although I put him into completely fictitious circumstances. And after he'd read the novel, he called me up about 6 weeks ago and told me how proud he was, how much he loved me. He completely opened up his heart to me in a way that he has not done, and what it did for me was to make me do the same thing. We were giggling on the phone to each other the other night like teenagers. It was amazing, these two old farts who'd finally reconciled with each other and were able to accept each other as who we were.
What do you think you saw in this novel that hadn't struck him in your earlier work that made him open up to you like that?
Well, I talk about the way I felt about losing my mother, which was something that he and I have never talked about, and discuss the moment of that loss and how it affected us both. The novel goes into the suicide of Gabriel's grandfather, which is something that was never discussed in the family. I have a similar situation in my own family. My father said to me rather touchingly, "I want you to know it wasn't as hard on me as you thought it was. I dealt with it. We just didn't talk about those things in those days." So I've always used writing as a way of emptying my own heart to the people I love, and I do it through fiction. It's not nonfiction. I mean, it's really futile to say what's true and what isn't true about this novel because it changes from sentence to sentence. But what I do try to make true is the emotions, and I have found from long experience that when I write about real experience, I reach people more directly because there's a ring of truth to it that cannot be duplicated in any other way. On the other hand, I am a completely instinctive storyteller. I want things to have a shape, to build. I want there to be that eerie moment where everyone shudders and says, "Oh no, I can't believe he did that." That's my instinct. That's what I'm happiest doing. I read a piece recently by Christopher Isherwood in which he talked about how he had those two instincts and they were constantly colliding and constantly getting him in trouble because people say, "Well, this is true. It must be true. It must have happened to you." No, you funnel things through your own emotions in order to make it seem true. And once you've accomplished that, you've reached your purpose.
My guest is Armistead Maupin. His new novel is called The Night Listener. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Armistead Maupin is my guest. He's best known for his Tales of the City series. His new novel is called The Night Listener. You know, one of the things, obviously, that gives your novel the ring of having some autobiography behind it is the fact that Gabriel, your main character, is a storyteller, and his stories are serialized on the radio, much as your Tales of the City stories were serialized in newspapers. And he describes his stories in a way that perfectly describes Tales of the City. He says, "My characters were a motley but lovable bunch, people caught in the supreme joke of modern life, who were forced to survive by making families of their friends." Perfect description of Tales of the City.
Yeah, I'm having some fun there, obviously. I'd be a very coy creature indeed if I didn't confess that I'm talking about myself there.
Is that how you'd always describe Tales, or did you kind of crystallize that description for this book?
No, I'd pretty much described it that way for a while. I had a pretty strong sense of what I was doing with Tales. And I must say I've come to approach Gabriel Noon even more than when I began to write the piece because the Night Listener was the first novel ever to be serialized on the internet in audio form prior to its publication. Salon.com has been running it as a serial. It's also available as an unabridged CD. And so, in essence, I became Gabriel Noon in the actual recording of the novel. So that was kind of a thrill for me. As you can tell, this whole novel is about the blurring between truth and fiction. And what are we to believe in the end? How do we tell stories to save our own lives? Because we all do it, not just storytellers. Every person on the planet anecdotalizes his own life in order to explain himself to himself and to other people. And this is about how are we to believe those stories? Who are we to trust? Gabriel Noon tells you from the very beginning that he's an unreliable narrator. He says, "I'm a fabulist by trade. I've spent my life looting my life for fiction, and I only save the shiny stuff." Well, that's a description of what I do. My memory of my life is not accurate. I have only memories of stories that I have constructed out of my life. And the people who know me know this about me. I've tried to be fastidiously honest about who I am throughout my career and to open up my heart as much as possible. But when it comes to storytelling, I'm really not to be trusted.
No. In the book, Gabriel's long-term lover has just left him. Jess, his lover of about 10 years, has had AIDS for several years. But after he starts taking the AIDS cocktail, when it appears his life will be longer than he expected, he leaves Gabriel. Why does he leave?
Well, I couldn't even begin to analyze that beyond what's written in the book. But I think what I was trying to capture there was a very real phenomenon that has happened because of protease inhibitors. People who thought they did not have a life suddenly have one, and there are enormous options that are open to them. And they want to be able to exercise those options. I can't speak for Terry. I mean, I won't speak for Terry. I probably could. I know him so well, and we still love each other so much. But I know that he felt, that Terry felt when he left, that he needed the chance to find out who he was separate from me now that he knew he was going to live. And because I was so socked into this cozy domesticity and used it to make myself feel secure and safe about myself, things, you know, my own sense of who I was fell apart. The amazing part about this story is that first chapter, the one I just read from, I was writing while I was in the midst of that pain, and the one person who was encouraging me to write it was Terry. He said, "This is what you do. Put it down on paper. Say what you feel. I don't care what you say. Just put it down." And then when the novel began to happen, at Terry's encouragement, he was always the one who came back to me and said, as he has said for many, many years, "Oh, you're just at that point where you think it's no good, but you've got to keep writing." And of course, he's been the one to promote and to, I mean, we remain business partners and family in the most extraordinary, loving kind of way. I can say with real honesty that we have more love and respect for each other than we had when we were romantically involved. It's been 4 years since we split, and it gets better every year because we know it's permanent now.
You know, your character, Gabriel, is so upset when his lover Jess leaves, and he realizes that he'd been imagining that Jess would have died in his arms, and that in fact he'd been planning, even romanticizing Jess's death to conceal the horror of losing him. Is that something you realized you'd been doing too?
Yes, absolutely. I did realize that, and that was one of the hardest things to write about. We all have to find ways to contain what pain we think is on the horizon for us, and for me it was the thought of losing Terry. It was enormous, and there had been models of these, you know, Paul Manette's extraordinary account of the death of his lover Roger in Borrowed Time. The people who were writing nonfiction at that time were really capturing something extraordinary, the love between two men where one of them, or maybe both of them, has a limited amount of life left. So in some way, I was embracing it long before I needed to. I mean, wasn't that the great, profound sort of cosmic joke of protease inhibitors? This thing that people assumed was final and for so long proved not to be. You know, people used to say to me that they were certain that I stopped writing Tales of the City because Michael Toliver had been described as being HIV positive. And they knew that I couldn't write anymore because he would surely be dead by now. And that used to really bother me because Michael tested positive at the same time Terry tested positive. It's why I made Michael positive. And Terry was still alive. And Terry is still alive after all these years. And this terrible thing that we assumed would happen did not happen. So there's a message even in that you can't count on anything. You can't count on death and you can't count on life.
Do you think there's a sense within a relationship when you expect that someone won't be able to survive for very long, that means neither of you will have the opportunity to betray each other, so that there's this kind of trust that maybe goes beyond what regular relationships have because time is so limited and you expect never to be betrayed?
There may be. I don't think that's a fair assumption to make about any relationship. I mean, the possibility of one person dying shouldn't really change the nature of the relationship. I suppose that the safest thing I could say about that is that when you think that somebody's going to die, you don't spend a lot of time being bored with each other.
Right.
And in some ways, that was an amazing feature of that knowledge. We packed our lives full of things to do. We took trips. We went to Lesbos with our friend Steve Beery, who died 6 years ago. We bought a farmhouse in New Zealand to have the experience of it, to know what it felt like to live out in the country and to be separate from the world. We found out and sold the farmhouse.
What didn't you like about that?
The commute was a killer, you know. It was a very, you know, it was a 14-hour plane flight, and it got to be rather existential. We were shipping hundreds of books to New Zealand and, you know, really setting down roots there in a very odd way, given that we felt Terry had a limited amount of time. But I'm so glad we did it. And it's a lesson to be remembered about life now. We still have to seize the moment, even when we think we're pretty sure we have more moments than we counted on.
Armistead Maupin will be back in the second half of the show. His new novel is called The Night Listener. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Armistead Maupin. He's best known for his Tales of the City, which started as a newspaper serial and was expanded into a series of novels and two TV miniseries. His new semi-autobiographical novel is called The Night Listener. It's about a writer who serializes his stories on the radio. His life is changed when his long-term lover leaves him and a mysterious 13-year-old fan enters his life. This novel seems to me in part to be about the main character's insecurities, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I figure perhaps there's some of your insecurities as well. For instance, the writer in your novel says, if Jess could walk out on the myth he'd helped create, the real me must be someone truly unlovable. And like the lover in your novel, Terry, who was your lover for many years and remains your business partner, really helped you in all the business aspects of writing,
marketing
the books, setting up the website, getting the deals, plus, you know, reading the fiction and commenting on it and giving you feedback. I mean, all of that. So is that like an insecurity that you feel you shared with your
Well,
character?
Yeah, to a certain degree. We go all sorts of dark places when we're breaking up with someone. There's no question about that. And I think that was my way of reminding myself not to believe in that myth. I think the hard part was losing the reality of my life temporarily in terms of not having that daily reinforcement from Terry. To this day, I value most the people I love, my little circle of friends. That's the real thing for me. When the sort of madness of publicity tours descends upon me and I feel really alienated from myself because I feel that I'm a commodity on some level, I retreat to the sort of bedrock knowledge of that I'm loved by people who actually know me, who know who I am. Because I'm never fully convinced that my readers completely understand who I am, warts and all. I probably have a way of glamorizing myself to such a degree that I don't feel that they totally know who I am. So, yeah, there was some of that insecurity. I've heightened all of Gabriel's insecurities. I mean, I took mine and went even deeper. There's a place in there where Gabriel says he feels that he might have broken into the temple of literature through an unlocked basement window. Well, that's a little bit the way I feel about having become a novelist by way of a daily newspaper serial. But it would be a little disingenuous to say that that's completely how I feel. I know that I'm good. I mean, I know I've worked very hard to become a writer over the last 25 years, and I know what I know how to do. So I'm not that insecure. But you know, your lead guy needs to be neurotic. It's more interesting. I mean, that's what Jimmy Stewart tells us about Vertigo. That film is so interesting to me today still because I'm the age that Jimmy Stewart was then, and I get it. I see what's going on. And I realize how complicated this mystery story becomes because of his neurosis.
You know, one of the things I love about Vertigo is that it's about finding what you think is your ideal in another person, realizing that person doesn't quite exist, but forcing them to become that ideal that you've constructed. You know, forcing somebody to be the person who you've imagined them to be, or you've been misled into thinking that they are.
And there's, of course, a parallel for that in The Night Listener.
Right.
And where Gabriel has to ask himself, does it matter? Does it really matter who I'm talking to in the end? If I've connected in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the nature of love, I mean, what I've come through, I mean, what I've really learned out of the experience of losing someone that I lived with for 10 years, or at least thinking I was losing him, was that when all else was stripped away, when the coziness of our domestic life was gone, when we weren't sleeping in the same bed, when I couldn't count on him being there every day, I was left with the love that we had for each other. And it was still there. It was in the room with me. And so we found a way to work through this. There was an account in the San Francisco Chronicle, a very crude account, trying to link the Night Listener with my own life, and ended up making it sounding like an airing of dirty laundry, I think was the term they used, almost as like an vindictive act. Well, anyone who's read the novel realizes that it's really about how two people make it through to the other side, how love becomes permanent.
What's it been like for you to be single again?
Freeing in many ways, especially since I still feel the connection of family to Terry and the people I love. I don't feel alone in that regard. But there's suddenly the opportunity to look at people on the street and think, or talk to somebody at a book signing and ask him out for a drink afterwards. And it's a second childhood of sorts. I'm rather enjoying it. And the pressure's off somehow. I've had my great love. I did it. It's still here. I know what that domestic thing felt like, and it was great most of the time. Don't get me wrong. I loved it. But at the same time, it's kind of nice to have the house to myself at times, to know that I don't have to, discuss with another person what we're going to eat that for dinner, or where we're going the next day, or how we're going to spend the weekend. There's a certain amount of freedom to be found in that.
Armistead, I know that as we're talking that Terry Anderson, who is the inspiration for the Jess character in your novel, he's your former lover and still business partner. He's been in the control room the whole time listening to the interview. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if it would be okay if we maybe invited him to the studio so I could ask him a few things about what it's like to be the inspiration for a character in your novel.
Sure. It's okay with me. Well, it looks like it's, he's signaling that he'd be glad to, so.
Well, why don't we take a break here while Terry comes in, and we'll be back with Armistead Maupin and Terry Anderson after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Armistead Maupin, and he's the author of Tales of the City. His new novel is called The Night Listener, and one of the characters in the novel, the character of Jess, is inspired by Armistead's former lover and still business partner, Terry Anderson, to whom the book is dedicated. So we've invited Terry into the studio. Terry, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's good to hear you again.
Terry, I'm wondering what it's like for you to be the inspiration for this character who's the cause of a lot of pain in the novel, because this character has walked out on the main character. He no longer wants to be lovers. He wants to kind of explore a little more independently his own life now that he knows he's going to live longer than he expected as a result of the new AIDS drugs. So what's it like to have inspired this character and to read it in the novel?
I think inspired is the operative word.
It's not you.
It's not me. It's not me. Rumors of my piercings are greatly exaggerated. there's some similarities. Yes, I have gone through a life-altering experience of thinking I was going to die and then giving it a reprieve, which has profoundly changed the way I view the world. I was glad to have Armistead have an outlet for it creatively. I think I revere writers and I revere the creative process, so I never wanted to interfere with it. Unlike his other novels where he's read them to me as he's written them, I asked that he not let me read this until he finished it, because I did not want to get in the way. If I saw something that really made me cringe, I didn't want to be responsible for ruining his process. So I sort of said, finish the book, let me read it, and then I'll take what I don't like out. So there's things that are very different about the two of us, but there's some very, I think, an emotional truth that's present in both of us. I mean, that we have this profound experience of saying, hey, I'm not going to die, and what do I do with my life now?
And I could never have written the novel if he had not given me that permission, if he had not said, given me the freedom to work all the way through it. And it was very strange because I didn't know what the end of it was. I was in the middle of my feelings when I was first trying to write it. And I thought, and much as Gabriel is, he keeps, throughout the novel, throughout The Night Listener, he says, How could I live this story if I don't know what the ending is? He's so used to constructing things for himself, and for once, he doesn't have an ending.
I think it's a risk that you take when anytime you get involved with a creative person. Anybody who gets involved with a creative person runs the risk of having their life looted. And by the time this book was written, I knew full well that that was possible. It's always been the way it's been. I mean, we've been lesbians in one book and, you know, gay couples in other books. And, you know, if he writes a book about dogs next, I'm sure we'll be puppies or something. But it's just what you do. It's part of the process. You know that he has to have some source material. And if I can be that, then I'm flattered.
Did you ever feel while you were reading the book the first time, like saying to Armistead, oh, sure, that's your interpretation of it, but that's not the way I saw it. Here's the way I saw it.
Well, you know, the whole book is one side of a story. I mean, it has to be the way it works is that a fiction writer writes about his experience. It's not my experience. So I know that that's always going to be his side of a story. And a good side, it's a love letter to me. I mean, I feel very flattered that he has written such a sweet book that's a fun read. It's not, you know, I don't take it, how do I say this? Without sounding like a, you know, a bitchy quality to it, it's not. It's a very loving portrait. It's still one side of a story.
Has it been at all difficult for you both to remain professional partners and good friends and not be lovers? I mean, there's a lot of former lovers who, you know, it's kind of all or nothing at all.
It's not that way with us. In the beginning, it was tough to sort of sever that part of it, to sort of say, okay, you know, the romantic part of it will not be there. But the reality was that we were always linking up and crying all over each other or holding hands or hugging, or we still do that. We still connect in those ways. We are still two deeply loving people, and it's I treasure that we've come through to the other side.
Armistead and I are and remain soulmates. We have always been. I think we were before we even met, frankly. We know what each other's thinking. We know each other better than anybody. I'm involved with someone else that I'm very much in love with now, and I sometimes worry about how he will feel like he fits into us because we're such a couple. Armistead and I will always be a couple. I think the funny thing about breaking up was our friends' reactions to it, saying, oh, you can't possibly break up. You're the best couple we know. And then the sort of, frankly, asinine kind of assumptions they'd make about how you're supposed to break up. You can't talk to him. You can't possibly have any connection with him because you have to have time to grieve it. You know, don't even talk to him. Cut off all relations. We didn't do it that way because we know each other. We know there's a core at which there's a core level of love that is important to us. And that's the thing we believed in, even when the romantic part or for my own needs changed or whatever, for whatever reasons I left, which are numerous and far too personal to go into. We didn't do it by the book, and that was part of the thing that sort of threw our friends.
Well, not our close friends, some of them. There was a difficult time, I think, for a while, but I think most people understand it now. It's the opportunity to be able to love the people that Terry loves is something that I've discovered. I mean, Terry and I were in London on the book tour, and it was late at night, and we were sort of feeling slightly insane in the way you do when you're on book tours, And Terry got on the phone to his boyfriend and started talking to him. And I suddenly wanted very much to get on the phone and tell the boyfriend that Terry had been talking about him to other people and that he missed him. And I knew that it was important for him to get back to him. There was a time when that would have been unimaginable to me, that I could pull that off. And it wasn't an effort this time. It was something that I truly wanted, because it just meant that the love was going off in that many more directions.
I think people paint themselves into a box a lot around relationships about how they're supposed to be. And to stop doing that and look at how you want to live your life free of all the societal expectations is a great freedom. And I feel very lucky that I think that's part of being gay, is that view of being an outsider is that it allows you to not view things within the box. And sort of notice the paradox of life, you know, how you can still love somebody but not want to live with them. You know, it's about expanding your notions of what relationships are. That's been the best part of this whole thing with Armistead. So we've been able to maintain a very, very solid relationship, even though it's changed forms.
Was separating made any more difficult by the fact that you're a pretty well-known couple? You know, because you work together, because you've done a lot of book tours together, you're a pretty well-known couple, and so you have this like image to live up to. And then if you decide to separate, it's like, well, you know, doesn't the public have a vote?
No.
They don't.
That's the great thing about our lives. I mean, what's going on between us is the strongest thing in my life. It's stronger than my career.
There was a pressure on me, to be honest with you, when I started thinking I need to stretch my wings, I need to have some time to myself, of thinking of the number of people I would disappoint. We have a friend who's an actor, a Broadway actor, who, when I called him to sort of say that I was doing this, he was like, "You're my heroes. You can't be breaking up." Which is a very odd position to be in, to sort of have to make that consideration. You know, when Ellen DeGeneres and Anne Heche, I just read that they were, you know, breaking up, I thought, I understand the pressure they both must have felt about being a symbol, not simply being a couple, not allowed to be the freedom of just being a couple in a relationship, but also to be a symbol for something larger. And we were that for some people. And as flattering as it is, there was a pressure on my part to sort of say, stay with it longer, to not hurt Armistead, and also not hurt a larger public.
Terry, when you read a novel like The Night Listener by, you know, a person who you're so close to, do you read it differently than you read another novel? I mean,
yes, with one eye closed.
That's sort of the way I read it, by the way. In the past, I've always had great luxury in sort of flipping through my novels and enjoying a paragraph that I'm especially proud of or something. And with The Night Listener, it's a little bit harder because there is stuff that gets so close to times when I was hurting that I just don't it's hard to do.
The first read of this novel was that way. I really had to sort of like put it down and come back to it a few times. It gets easier after you sort of get some distance on it because I realized that no one has the personal investment in the material that I do, because there are some very autobiographical parts of this book. So it's bound to strike me. I can rake over it with a fine-tooth comb much better than anyone else can, so I have to remember that when I read it. But upon the third reading of the book, when we were sitting down to do the audio version of it and deciding what was going to stay in and what was going to go and how we were going to produce it, I thought, you know, it's a good book. It's a good yarn. I'm glad to be a part of it, and it doesn't seem as I don't flinch quite as much on the second reading.
And I told him that Russell Crowe could play him in the movie. So.
when you and Armistead broke off, and you decided, you know, you needed more freedom and some independence, and probably also to figure out who you were outside of that orbit. Did you want to leave the business too temporarily, and just have a business that was separate from that relationship?
No, I think I've had felt invested in our relationship and the business as well. We've been so linked in that way for so long. I know it. I've been working in this field, the Maupin field, for a lot of years now. You know, so it'd be like starting over. My midlife crisis did not involve a career change.
Armistead, given how complicated semi autobiographical fiction is, do you think you'd ever write a memoir?
No, ma'am.
I hope not.
Please, no. Well, you know, that's why I like fiction. A memoir really does require the truth in a major way. And what is the truth when it comes down to your memories? It's a completely subjective thing. At least I have a certain remove in The Night Listener. I can say these are fictional characters. This is about two people that I've invented. Terry and I have even actually come to see them that way. You can get some distance on it, but when you're writing an autobiography, you've really got to get every single thing right. And the hardest thing about writing this book for me was I was desperately afraid that I would hurt someone that I loved, and that includes just about everybody in the book. I really wanted to tap the truth of those emotions, but I did not want to hurt a single soul in the process of doing it.
Well, I thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Armistead Maupin is the author of the new novel, The Night Listener. The novel is dedicated to Terry Anderson. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel by the author of The Remains of the Day. This is Fresh Air.